Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm really excited today to interview Dr. Timothy Snyder. Known to his first grade class in the old days as Mr. Tim, he is the Hossam Professor of History at Yale University, a permanent fellow at the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna. Professor Snyder is one of America's leading historians and public intellectuals, and he joins us today to talk about his latest book on tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. Professor Snyder received his doctorate from the University of Oxford in 1997, where he's a British Marshall Scholar. Before joining the faculty at Yale in 2001, he held fellowships in Paris, Vienna, and Warsaw, and an Academy Scholarship at Harvard. He speaks 5 and reads 10 European languages. Dr. Snyder has published 6 single-authored, award-winning books, all of which have been translated, including Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, 2010, which won 12 awards, including the Emerson Prize in the Humanities, a Literature Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, the Leipzig Award for European Understanding, and the Hannah Arendt Prize in Political Thought. And his last book was Black Earth, The Holocaust as History and Warning, in 2015. Professor Snyder has also written for the New York Review of Books, Foreign Affairs, The Times Literary Supplement, The Nation, and The New Republic, as well as The New York Times, The International Herald Tribune, The Wall Street Journal, and other newspapers. Professor Snyder was the recipient of an inaugural Andrew Carnegie Fellowship in 2015 and received the Havel Foundation Prize the same year. He's a member of the Committee on Conscience of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, the faculty advisor for the Fortunoff Collection of Holocaust Testimonies at Yale, and sits on the advisory councils of the YIVO Institute for Jewish Research and other organizations. We'll talk to Professor Snyder about all of this and more. But first, welcome, Professor Timothy Snyder.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So you wrote a book which got everybody's ears up, in which you basically said we could be tracking towards, if I didn't misread you, towards a coup in this country. Something I thought from the beginning, too. Did you mean that?
Look, it's, I think, important not to just imagine it all as some kind of dramatic moment where, you know, everything's fine and then suddenly there's a coup. I'm a historian and I tend to be skeptical about the claims that countries make about themselves. So, for example, Americans say we've been a democracy for 200 years. What could possibly go wrong? We haven't really been a democracy for 200 years. Women can vote for a century, African Americans for half a century. In the last 20 years, we've been trending away from democracy. Because I'm a historian of Eastern Europe, it's normal to me that democracies fail. They fail most of the time. Most of the democracies founded after 1918, after the First War, failed. Most of the democracies founded after 1945, at least in Eastern Europe, also failed. And so that for me is normal. So what I try to do in the book is to connect my experience as a historian of how and why democracies tend to fail, how and why authoritarian, even totalitarian regimes emerge, to connect that with an American tradition, which is the skepticism of the Founding Fathers. The Founding Fathers were very worried that their experiment, their republic, was going to fail. If you read their correspondence, they generally tended to think it might last for a generation or two, but they were not particularly optimistic. They were concerned because they too looked at history, the history they knew, classical history, and saw that democracies generally tended to fail. So I'm not trying to say something dramatic in the book like, oh yes, you know, all of a sudden from one day to the next, everything's going to go badly. What I'm trying to say is that, look, we're living in the real world. Our democracy has some major flaws already. Democracies generally tend to fail. We've now elected someone who has no respect whatever for basic American traditions. So rather than just worry, here are some things that we can do. That's the point of the book.
And what can we do?
We can do an awful lot. So look, I mean, history, I bring history into this conversation first to make things more serious and to broaden them, and second to give people a plausible idea about what we can do. We live way too much in the day-to-day. We get overwhelmed by the news, whether we're happy or unhappy with the present situation. Our scenarios of how political change takes place are, I think, too often framed by Hollywood. You know, someone's going to come in at the last moment and save us. There's going to be a dramatic moment. You know, it's good versus evil. Totalitarianism is not like that. Authoritarianism is not really like that. So history, on the one hand, gives a sense of how bad things can get. It gives us a sense that, you know, when a globalization is challenged, like ours is being challenged, you can have seriously radical rivals to liberalism and democracy who have seriously radical alternatives, which I'm afraid some of the people in the White House do. History teaches us that that's normal, because after all, what we're in now is not the first globalization. It's actually the second one. And the first one in the late 19th and early 20th centuries had basically the same trajectory as the one we have now, expanding trade, expanding growth, and then basic optimism about the future, that growth would bring enlightenment, would bring liberalism, would bring democracy, and so on. We had much the same pattern in the late 20th, early 21st centuries. And so the early 20th century teaches us how things can go wrong. So we shouldn't be surprised if things are going wrong, if people challenge globalization, if people challenge democracy. That's normal. On the other hand, what history does is it reminds us that in that whole century, between when democracy started to fail the last time and now, there have been lots of really interesting, intelligent, and courageous people. In my field, those people are Germans or Czechs or Russians or Ukrainians or Poles who have experienced this and learned from it and tried to leave us a legacy, a really generous legacy of what we can do. Anyway, I'm saying all that because I don't want to cut right to the chase and say history says X, because history is more a way of spreading out your mind, buying yourself some time, bracing yourself, and realizing that there are things you can do because people in tougher situations than you and people who are smarter than me or you have come up with ideas. Anyway, I'll give you number one. The most important thing to do is not to obey in advance. This is number one of the 20 lessons. Don't obey in advance. The reason why it's the most important is that it's a precondition psychologically and also politically for any other form of resistance. So the way things usually work in social and political life is that we adjust. Something changes and we make adjustments. And that's totally normal. In fact, it's usually appropriate. It's appropriate that I have the microphone in front of my face. It's appropriate that I'm answering your questions. We all adjust to new things. The crucial thing is that at certain moments, adjustment is not appropriate. If you want to be a free person, you have to recognize that historical moments arise where it's just not appropriate to adjust. And then all you have to do is not adjust. It's not even a matter of disobeying orders yet. It's just a matter of recognizing that it's not that you're weird, it's that the world is weird, and that you're not going to drift with it. You're not going to drift along with everyone else. You're not going to normalize. You're going to stop and think about what you really care about, what you wish to preserve, what you wish to sustain. Now, this is what not obeying in advance means. It just means stopping and taking stock and not doing what everyone else does. This is psychologically really important because if you do it at the beginning of a moment like this one, then you have a chance to do other things, which in the book are lessons 2 to 19. It's also really politically important, and this is what we know from history. What we know from history is that authoritarian regimes require consent. They don't require consent in the sense of voting or marching even, but they require consent in the sense of people normalizing, people adjusting, people choosing not to do anything, people saying mañana, you know, I'll just wait, I'll do something tomorrow maybe, and then doing that forever. So politically, the moment you have is the first moment when the regime actually requires your help. If you blow that moment, if you don't do anything at the beginning, then you're done.
So, Professor Timothy Snyder of Yale, let me ask you this. You have a colleague in the academy, of course. You know of him, James Barber, who wrote about presidential character. How much does the character of the actor in the office have to do with what you're writing about, as opposed to the historical antecedents and the trajectory we're on?
I guess there are three parts to what I'm trying to say, and the character of the president of the United States is one of those parts. One part of what I'm trying to say is that history is much more open for good and for evil than we generally recognize. Things are much more fluid than we recognize. Tomorrow can be much more different from today than we generally recognize, and we know that by looking at yesterday. That's the first part of what I'm trying to say. The third part of what I'm trying to say is that if we're aware of history and its lessons, we can really make a difference. It's precisely in moments like this that individual citizens have much more power than they're aware of. It's in moments like this where little things like a glance, a handshake, a conversation, a subscription to a newspaper actually have political significance. So in the middle of that, the second part of what I have to say, of course, has to do with the character of the President of the United States. Because yes, it's true that even though there are these, you know, historical tendencies and there are these structural problems with American democracy, it matters very much that the President of the United States has no experience in government whatsoever. It matters very much that the President of the United States has no sense, as far as I can tell, for some of the basic American traditions, such as the rule of law. His life has been one long brush with the law. It matters that the President of the United States has no respect for democracy. He said that if the elections turned against them, he wouldn't accept the results. It matters that the President of the United States, rather than accepting basic American traditions like law and democracy, openly admires foreign dictators around the world. This is extremely significant because it gives you a sense of his imagination of what America should be like. It should be an authoritarian country. In his pronouncements about journalists or about judges, we see very clearly, again, the imagination of a man who would like for America to be not what it is, which is a kind of mixed, pluralist, imperfect republic, but an authoritarian state. So yes, of course, I mean, character in the sense of what's in the man's mind, what comes out of the man's mouth, makes it clear that this is someone who is an aspiring tyrant. That, I think, is fairly clear. The question is whether what's in the man's mind can actually become real. And if we don't want America to be an authoritarian regime, then it's up to us to try to make that stop.
We're talking with Yale professor Timothy Snyder about his latest book, On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. Okay, so Professor Snyder, Tim, which I know you asked me to call you, I guess the question is whether or not the people somebody surrounds himself with becomes an indicator of where we're going. I take it you've thought about that.
Well, yeah. I mean, the clearest lesson from that would be that we're going to Russia, right? So mentally, Mr. Trump surrounds himself with Vladimir Putin. Over and over and over during the campaign trail, he expresses admiration for Mr. Putin and his desire to have a closer relationship with Russia. This strikes me as being extremely important because I think, I mean, putting aside for a second the question of Russian interference in our elections, the fact that Russia is a positive model for Mr. Trump is very instructive. Now, if you look at the way he ran his campaign, you get closer and closer to Russia. The person who wrote his first foreign policy speech, Richard Burt, was on the payroll of a Russian gas company. The person who was Mr. Trump's first advisor on Russian affairs, Carter Page, was also on the payroll of a Russian gas company. The person who became Mr. Trump's advisor on national security issues, and then as president, his actual national security advisor, Michael Flynn, was on the payroll of a Russian propaganda outlet, RT. Mr. Trump chose Paul Manafort to run his campaign. Paul Manafort wasn't paid by the Trump campaign. One wonders by whom Paul Manafort was paid. What we do know about Paul Manafort is that he offered to President Putin to soften up American democracy for Russian influence. What we do know about Paul Manafort is that for the past quarter century, his job description has basically been dictator rescue. His job right before he was the campaign manager of Mr. Trump was to be the main advisor of a Ukrainian president who ended up aspiring to become a dictator and was thrown out of office. Someone who was very close to President Putin, and more importantly, was also a kleptocrat, someone who ruled by stealing. So the whole gamut of people that Mr. Trump surrounded himself with during the campaign suggests someone who aspires to be a Russian-style leader. That, for me, is probably the most important answer to your question. If you look at the people who have joined since, it's also striking that people who then join, like Jared Kushner becomes the most important or the second most important advisor, in order to get national security clearance in the White House, Mr. Kushner has to lie about his contacts with Russia, which he does. The Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, who was a minor player during the campaign, he perjures himself during his confirmation hearings to become the highest law enforcement official in the land. He purges himself precisely on the issue of his contacts with Russia. So the more we go on, I mean, the stronger the case seems that what he's surrounding himself with is people who represent these connections to Russia. In addition to that, of course, you have the people, you know, you have the standard Republicans who think that tax cuts and so on are going to create all kinds of magic. That's also present. And for many people, that adds an element of normality. I'm afraid that in politics, what massive tax cuts and cutbacks in government protections are going to do is actually generate chaos. But maybe that's a different question.
You referenced it. I want to go back to it if we can for a moment. And that is his idea that this election is going to be rigged until it wasn't rigged. He gets into office. What I've been saying for a long time, it's scary how much I agree with everything you've written, is that when 4 years are up and let's say his numbers, his polling numbers are in the 20s, and he turns around and says, well, we certainly can't have a fair election here. This is going to be the real rigged election. Isn't that the kind of potential that we face for a coup?
I think something along those lines. We have to remember that Mr. Trump and the people with whom he's close, both the people who are Americans and the people who are not, are very intelligent in certain political ways. You know, Mr. Trump is not a good administrator. He doesn't have patience. He doesn't really like to write. He doesn't really like to read. It's easy to laugh at those kind of things, but he clearly has a certain kind of political intelligence. And the people who advised him during the campaign, Paul Manafort, for example, certainly have a great deal of political intelligence. And these people are thinking in the same world that we're thinking. So, I mean, I have a slightly different thought, which is you have a president who doesn't care about democratic procedures one way or the other, and who also doesn't have any popular policies. You have a Congress where people may be used to elections more than the president, but they also don't have any popular policies. The tax cuts for the rich, the ending of Obamacare, poisoning the water and air, warming the climate, these are not actually popular issues in the United States. I mean, they have some support here and there for some of those things, but in terms of the actual majority, you're not going to get a majority for ending Obamacare. You're not going to get a majority for tax cuts that favor the rich. You can pass them, but they're not going to be popular. And so my concerns have more to do with 2018. I'm concerned that it's not 2020, but it'll be 2018 where the president's approval ratings are in the 20s, where the Republicans have little choice but to run from him. But there is actually a choice. And the choice is you take advantage of a foreign war or a terrorist attack to say there's some kind of state of emergency now. Therefore, we're going to have to suspend the elections or we're going to have to hold them under special conditions, where the special conditions mean even more voter suppression, right? Where the special conditions mean that we have even less Democratic elections than we have at present.
Part of your very scary book and that is getting so much appropriate attention is how far we got towards this model that you've created. However, here the ball of twine is unraveling. All of the things you've been talking about, one day after another, after another, after another, we're hearing Trump sort of defrocked. Do you think the chance of going towards this kind of evolutionary coup is as great now as when he started? Or is it too late for him?
You know, I don't like to treat politics like sports. You know, like I watch basketball or I watch baseball or I watch football and I have opinions about who's going to win, but I don't participate. Right. Like I don't get out there on the field for Ohio State. Thank God for Ohio State. You know, I don't get out there and try to play shortstop for the Cincinnati Reds. I just spectate. I have opinions about where it's going to go. You see what I mean? Politics isn't like that. So I can't really answer your question about whether it's more or less likely, because I think that primarily depends upon us. The president is not going to change. The president has certain fixed ideas. He has certain habits. And frankly, he's not the youngest man in the world. So he's not going to change. The variable in all of this is how Americans react. The question is whether, you know, the America that he sees in his mind, the America where white people are in charge, you know, where wealth is concentrated, where foreign policy has nothing to do with principles, where democracy is kind of a sham, as he says over and over again, whether that America becomes real doesn't depend on him. Someone who has that kind of personality, he's going to punch at the walls, right? He's going to push on the walls. He's going to keep trying. He's going to push every wall. That's what he's going to do because his personality doesn't match the system. The question is whether those walls give in, whether the system holds up, and that depends upon whether we support the system. So, I mean, if you're asking whether or not I think things are going better or going worse, I wrote the book back in November. I mean, the 20 lessons were in November. The whole book was done in December. Basically, people tend to think that I predicted certain things correctly. But the book is not just a prediction. It's mainly an encouragement for American citizens and others to act. So insofar as there's a chance that we get out of this, it's going to depend upon our continuing to recognize our responsibilities as American citizens and acting. Sure, it's true. You know, the journalists are doing a great job. Some lawyers are doing a great job. Some civil servants are doing a great job, but they will lose unless they feel like and they have support from larger stretches of the population and from civil society.
I'm so glad you're saying this. I mean, I've been watching. I went to one of the marches, the women's march in the beginning, and, you know, there was a sea of people forever and everybody came out. Now, not so much. People are still coming out, but not in the numbers they were in the beginning. And my hypothesis here is that's because they don't think the situation is as serious as it once was. What do you make of that?
I don't know about that. I mean, I think, look, America is a big country, and these events kind of roll out in waves, you know, from Washington, D.C., and are picked up and understood differently at different times in different places. So people in California tend to think the situation is extremely grave, but we're protected from it by our own institutions, by sheer distance, by our local wealth. In the Midwest, in the cities, I think in general, the sense of danger is growing rather than receding. And I get this just from being in Midwestern cities recently. I think in the East Coast and in big cities, at least on the East Coast, there was a sense right at the beginning that one has to do something, hence the women's marches, which were the largest public demonstration in the history of the United States of America, which is something worth noting. That's a standard which is hard to live up to later. But I think a lot of what's happened is that marches are not just there to generate more marches. I mean, more marches are good. There's going to be a March for Truth on the 3rd of June in a couple of dozen cities about the Russia investigation. That's a good thing. Marches are good. But marches are also there to keep people going to do other things. Mm-hmm. Marches are there to teach you that you're not alone, to help you make new friends. And then you go on at the level of the neighborhood or the level of the city to continue activism. And across the country, there are lots of new groups, which didn't exist before. People who march, but who also do things day to day. And one of the things I'm trying to say in the book is that there are actually a lot of easy things you can do day to day. The ways that you talk to people, for example, the ways that you comport yourself, what you choose to read, what you choose to pass on the internet, which actually have magnified political importance. So marching's a really good thing, but also having just a simple daily routine where you end up making a little bit of a positive difference, that's very important too.
So we here at WAMC, 29 stations, Greater Northeast Quadrant, we had a fund drive about 4 months ago. And it was the time I think when the apprehension was greatest. And incredibly, I never thought I'd live to see it, we made $1 million in a day. Now, when the newspapers called and said, how did you do that? I said, it was all Trump. I believe it was all Trump. I think people are still concerned, but I don't think the same way that they were in the very beginning.
Yeah, well, partly it's the nature of time, right? It's that, you know, something that was truly surprising for a lot of people happened. And I think it's remarkable that so many people then chose to react the next day. But no one can keep up that kind of pressure every day. There can't be a women's march every day. And what I do hear from a lot of people is, okay, now I'm tired. And my answer to that is that we're not allowed to be tired.
Right.
If you're tired, spend less time on the news. You know, don't wear yourself out by reading the news for 5 hours every night and going to sleep exhausted. Just limit yourself to 1 hour. If you're tired, you know, make sure you're doing things politically that are physical, that make you feel better, like walking to your friend's house or taking part in a march. If you're tired, remember that, you know, it was 150 years into the history of this country before African Americans began to vote. If African Americans can wait 150 years, you know, then other people can work for a year or 2 years or 3 years or 4 years. The tiredness trope is something that we have to get over because, of course, it's not that the danger goes away. It's just that we have to learn to organize our energies for the middle term and for the long term. You know, there's no easy gratification here. It's great to march. Marching should continue, but then it has to be the first step towards something else. And what can't happen is that people come together and one says, I'm tired, and the other says, yeah, I'm tired too. What has to happen is what Morrison says, I'm tired, and the other person says, yeah, I understand that, but here's something else that we need to do, right? Because it's changing the way you live a tiny little bit, which is going to end up making the difference. It's not like a big burst, and then either you win or you lose. You know, that's the Hollywood part. That's the superhero part, right? I mean, Wonder Woman is opening in June. Wonder Woman isn't going to come crashing down out of Atlantis, wherever she comes from, and save us. There's no moments like that. What there are instead are daily actions or weekly actions. So, yeah, I mean, people might be tired and then say, oh, well, I'm not as concerned as I was before. But no, I mean, we're not allowed to be tired, and we have to continue to be concerned until we're out the other side of this.
So Dick Nixon had to off himself. He basically retired. The Constitution prevailed. Do you see any major differences between the evolution of the country, Professor Snyder, between Dick Nixon and Trump?
Yeah, there are at least two things I would point to. The first is that the Republican Party has changed significantly. The Republican Party is, to its credit, much better organized than the Democratic Party now or the Republican Party in the early 1970s. But part of being better organized is living as a kind of movement, sometimes with a certain indifference to facts in the real world, which might be problematic. So the Russia scandal is obviously much worse than Watergate, if it's true. Watergate was about a minor interference, you know, in a presidential contest carried out by a few Americans. If the Russia story is true, then we have, I mean, we know we have a foreign power interfering in our elections, which is dramatic enough. If that foreign power was cooperating with members of the Trump campaign, that's obviously 100 times worse than Watergate or 1,000 times worse than Watergate. It's just shockingly awful. But what we see is that in the Republican Party, because it functions as a kind of movement, its members are pretty good at shielding themselves from things that maybe are real, but that they don't like. And so rather than asking the question, is it or is it not true that Mr. Trump and his associates cooperated with a foreign power to throw the American presidential election, Republicans have a certain tendency to say, is this story good for me or not? If it's not good, then it's an invention, then it's fake news. So that's something that's changed, which I think is not really good for the country, because these things are not partisan issues. You know, whether or not we can run a democratic election without having a foreign power throw it is not a partisan issue. That's an issue about the character. So that's one thing's changed. Another thing which has changed, which is related, is the character of information culture. So in the 70s, the Washington Post breaking a story, you know, God bless what the Washington Post is doing now, by the way. I mean, they're actually more amazing by far in 2017 than they were in 1973. I mean, the number of stories that they're breaking, the reportage that they're doing is incredible. But we don't live in the same information culture. So it's no longer the case that there really are national newspapers. It takes a lot more work to penetrate down to local opinion because people are basically living in the internet. And again, that gives them a way to shield themselves from things that are happening out in the real world. And that means the whole dynamics of scandal are very different. I think we're all a little bit unsure about where that's going to lead.
We're talking to Professor Timothy Snyder from Yale University about his latest book on tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. So you wrote in your book, as I remember it, about the Reichstag. You know, the tyrants need a Reichstag fire to sort of buttress their case for taking over. So you see any Reichstag fires on the horizon here? I've been thinking maybe North Korea, maybe atomic weapons. I don't know.
Yeah. So let me just take a moment to explain the Reichstag fire scenario. So Hitler's party, the National Socialist Party, in November of 1932, won an election. This is really important to remember because most of the time in the 21st century, it's also true that the people who are now tyrants, the people who now run authoritarian regimes, have an election somewhere in the background. So elections are very often part of the process, at least in an authoritarian regime. You can't say just because someone won an election, therefore they're a Democrat. That's simply not true, right? And of course, that's directly relevant to Mr. Trump, who all that spent 2016 discrediting the whole idea of democracy until he won, right? At which point democracy was all right for a few days or for a few weeks. So Hitler won an election, which allowed him to become Chancellor of Germany. When he became Chancellor of Germany, he was still in charge of something called the Republic. It was the Weimar Republic. How was Hitler able to change Germany so quickly? After the election, after he was named chancellor, a month after he was named chancellor, someone set fire to the German parliament, which is called the Reichstag. And Hitler then used that moment of great fear, he used that moment to transform the state. He had a state of emergency declared, Germans ceded their basic civil rights, and that state of emergency continued all the way until 1945, until the end of the Second World War, until Hitler's suicide. So that is a kind of template for modern tyrants. Most modern tyrants are in some kind of relationship with terrorism. They don't want too much, but they don't want none at all either. They want the threat of terrorism because the threat of terrorism is the thing that they use to silence opposition. And the moment of terrorism is the thing that they use to change institutions. So we see this over and over again. A recent example is how Mr. Putin rose to power in Russia, where in late 1999, a series of buildings were destroyed in Russian cities, and Mr. Putin blamed Muslim terrorists and began a war, and that was the beginning of his popularity. It turns out that in all likelihood, those incidents were staged, and it was the Russian state killing its own people. But who does it matters less than the effect that a terrorist attack will have.
So let me question you about that. You're a distinguished Holocaust scholar, and we know that. So it doesn't matter whether Hitler set the Reichstag on fire himself or somebody else did it?
Look, okay, it matters, of course. You're right. It matters, of course, for the historical record. So, I mean, if we want to get things right, we would like to know whether the Reichstag was actually set aflame by a single Dutchman, whether it was actually set on fire as Hitler claimed as a result of a communist plot, whether it was set on fire by German policemen acting on orders. If we want to get history right, we need to know those things. It wasn't a communist plot, by the way. The general consensus is that it was a Dutchman acting alone. There are still people who maintain, however, that there's good evidence that Hitler set the fire himself, or not he did it personally, but that there was some kind of organized provocation there. When I say it doesn't matter, what I mean is this. You will not figure out in time who did it. All that you will have at the time are going to be your emotions. So if there is, God forbid, a terrible terrorist attack in the American city in the next few days, weeks, or months, we won't know in time exactly what happened. We have to make up our minds what we're going to do before we know who did it. And that means that you have to recognize that whatever the government says it was A, it was B, it was C, whatever the government says, the most important thing is to protect your own rights. Sure, the government should act against whoever did it, whoever that turns out to be. But on day one, the greatest risk is to your own liberty. You have to make sure that when you protest, when you stand up, when you speak out, you're speaking out for your own freedom. Because the way the Reichstag fire scenario works is, in the moment of confusion and grief and fear, you trade your real freedom for fake safety. And then whatever else happens later, it's very hard to get that freedom back.
Well, Professor Timothy Snyder, I couldn't agree with you more about that, but I want to stay on this for a second and ask you, well, let's just say that Trump decides, as his numbers fall and fall and fall, that maybe it's time to really do something really tough to the North Koreans. Then the question is, why did he do it, right?
Yeah, thanks. You were prodding me for scenarios, and I never actually gave you one. I mean, the thing is that the world is full of possibility for this kind of action. So I try to think less about what Mr. Trump would be thinking. I think he's made that perfectly clear if we want to listen. I mean, Mr. Trump doesn't like checks and balances. He doesn't like freedom of expression. He doesn't like the rule of law. You know, Mr. Trump has said he admires the way Russia deals with terrorism. The way Russia deals with terrorism is that it uses the threat of terrorism to consolidate an authoritarian regime. This is all pretty clear. You know, he makes that clear. So we can speculate about what the scenario might be. The important thing for me is that whatever it looks like, whether it's a war with North Korea, whether it's a domestic terrorist incident, whether it's something else, whatever it is, it's the rights of people in the United States that come first. It's not the momentary threat which seems to demand that we give up those rights, which is most important. It's our rights which are most important. There's no reason for us to give up our rights in order to trust this man to make us more secure. And the reason why I stress this is that not only is there a whole world full of possible threats, there's also the whole spectrum of possibilities between real and fictional. There are real terrorist attacks. There are terrorist attacks that are provoked. There are terrorist attacks which are carried out by, sad to say, governments against their own citizens. All these things are possible, but we're not going to have the time to figure out just how real something is. We're only going to have the time to decide, do we give up our rights or not? And the important thing is not to do it.
Well, you're the historian, and you've done so well, and you've been honored so many times. So you tell me, if it's a matter of personal security versus giving up your rights, what's your fear?
My fear is that people see that as a trade-off, because it's not. This whole idea that there's an automatic trade-off between safety and freedom is just not true. It's very possible to be unfree and unsafe. That's what it's like to live under an authoritarian regime. You're neither safe nor free. You're not free because it's a government that can do things to you. And you're also not safe because it's a government that can do things for you. So, I mean, what I worry about is precisely that we've already accepted that there's a trade-off. As I see it, being safe is a good thing and being free is a good thing. And it's the government's job to try to maximize good things. Basically, when someone comes to you and says, under any circumstances, I'm going to make you more safe, but you have to be less free, you should be very, very suspicious of that trade-off, because usually people who are making that proposition want to get rid of both freedom and safety. So I just question the whole framework, basically. I mean, there are definitely ways to prevent terrorism. Terrorism is a real problem in the world, but it's less clear to me that making a whole society less free reduces terrorism. Countries that are authoritarian are also victims of terrorism as well. But the most important thing is not to accept that trade-off, or to be very critical about that trade-off, to make sure the government has explained to you very clearly how my not having due process of law possibly makes any difference to Islamic terrorism. I don't see the connection. I think that case has to be made really powerfully before we give up. And the danger is, when something blows up and people die, we're then in a different frame of mind than we are now, and we want someone to rescue us. But that's the trap, precisely. That's the trap.
Let's move to newspapers. Newspapers, as you remember, Tim Snyder, are the, quote, enemy of the people. Not Ibsen, but enemy of the people. Why should this be so disturbing to us? You were right when you talked about the Washington Post and the New York Times. But here's a guy who says, I want to be able to sue them for what they say. I want to make the libel laws easier. What do you make of all of that?
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. If you want to have a democracy, if you want to have a rule of law state, you have to have freedom of press. You have to have an ideal of factuality. Because if you don't think that there are facts, then it's impossible to have a civil society. It's impossible to cooperate. It's impossible to have normal political life. On the other hand, if you want to build an authoritarian regime, And it doesn't even matter which kind. It can be far right. It can be fascist. It could be far left. It could be communist. It could be something else. But if you want to build an authoritarian regime, one of the first things you have to do is get rid of facts. Because if you get rid of facts, you can get rid of trust. If you get rid of trust, you get rid of the possibility of resistance. You know, so if you're an authoritarianism, if you're an authoritarian, what you want to have is a monopoly on the mind. And what you're going to give people is a big myth. You're going to give them a bunch of illusions, you know, a bunch of stories. You're going to give to them day after day. And that's the kind of, that's in President Trump's wheelhouse. He likes to make stuff up. He likes to have big stories. He doesn't like people to disagree with him. So he's, in those ways, he's perfectly suited to be an authoritarian strongman. You know, congratulations to him. If you want to do that, your rival for the monopoly on the mind is those stubborn people who insist, no, it's not just fiction that matters. It's not just myth that matters. It's not just feel-good stories that matter. It's also the facts. It's also the facts which allow the individual to reason, allow the individual to become an informed citizen, to make up her or his own mind about the day, about the decision, right? So of course he's against freedom of the press. Of course he's against the newspapers because he's an authoritarian, right? In his own mind, if he wants to transform the United States into an authoritarian regime, he's absolutely right that the newspapers are his enemy, not because they dislike him personally, but because in the kind of America he imagines, there can't be real newspapers because there can't be real sources of fact.
We're talking with Yale professor Timothy Snyder about his latest book on tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. And Tim, I want to go back and ask you about getting rid of the facts, which you've talked about. A lot of people think that Trump is stupid because one day he says one thing, the next day he does the exact opposite, and that he can't keep track. Some people say he's Alzheimer's disease and, you know, he can't keep track of what he says on one day or another. But I think you're talking about something a little bit more ominous here, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, it's very important when you're dealing with political figures of this kind not to judge them by standards that aren't appropriate. I mean, Hitler contradicted himself all the time, too. Stalin contradicted himself all the time, too. Authoritarians generally contradict themselves. Part of being authoritarian is having the power to contradict yourself, right? That's what it's all about. If you're going to be a democratic leader, you have to live in the real world with your people. You have to listen to what they say about the real world and try to come up with ideas which will become policies which will benefit people. If you're going to be an authoritarian, precisely having the power to contradict yourself all the time is essential not only to your daily work, but it's essential to your personality. And that's what I mean when I say that Mr. Trump has the personality that he has, and he's going to keep pounding against the walls, the limits of the system, and see whether it can match his personality. His personality is not going to change. It's the system that around him that might or might not change. So yeah, I agree completely. It's not, I wouldn't dismiss him. He has obvious gaps that make him unfit to be a chief executive of the United States, let alone of anything, frankly. A chief executive needs to be a good manager. He needs to know how to read. He needs to know how to write. He needs to make decisions. But he's not actually after being chief executive. He's after being leader. And leader is something else. So yeah, I think it's something much more ominous. If what Mr. Trump's behavior leads towards is a natural path towards authoritarianism, where the first thing you do is you just lie all the time, which is Mr. Trump's 2016 presidential campaign in one sentence. Most of the factual claims he made were not true. One count found that 87% of them were just not true. So first, you lie all the time. You just get people used to a landscape, a public landscape, which is just littered with falsehood. The second thing you do, and this is Mr. Trump, you know, December of last year, January of this year until now, is that you say, no, it's not me who lies. It's the newspapers who lie. They lie. They're the enemies. They make the fake news. And then the third step when you win is when everyone looks around and says, oh, well, who knows what's truth anyway? You have your truth. I have my truth. You have your opinion. My opinion is just as good as your opinion. And once you do that, you win. Because if people have given up on the existence of facts, then they have no basis whatever to judge you and to resist you. And you win because as the leader, you're the biggest spectacle. You've now achieved this monopoly of the mind because the newspapers, even if they still exist, don't have any influence because nobody really believes in or cares about the facts anymore. So Mr. Trump's behavior is admirably coherent and clear. If the goal is to try to pave the way for an authoritarian regime change. I mean, I get frustrated as other people do, but I think it's important to give credit where credit is due. Some of the things that Mr. Trump does are perfectly coherent and sensible if the goal is to undermine existing American political culture.
Which brings me back to the Republicans and Mitch McConnell, of all people. Mitch McConnell got mad one day. I was watching the TV, and he got up and on CNN, and he was angry. It was clear that he was dissatisfied with Trump wanting to do the nuclear option to the filibuster on regular legislation. And he said, that is not going to happen. Democrats and Republicans resist it and won't do it. And to me, that was a very defining moment, because McConnell, who has supported the president all along, said, this is protection of this institution of the Senate. What do you think about that?
I think there's something in there, but I wouldn't put too much stock in it. I mean, first of all, I mean, the way I would recast that is that the president is so impatient with the division of powers, the checks and balances that are characteristic of our system, that in his first few days and weeks in office, he tries to challenge them in obvious ways. He complains over and over again how hard it is to pass legislation because, you know, you have to get a vote and people have to talk about it. He's very frustrated with all this. He clearly would prefer to govern by decree. And of course, that's what he tried. His first 3 days out of the gate, he tried to govern by decree. And fortunately, it didn't work. So yeah, I think there are going to be procedural moments where some Republicans are going to have a sense that their institution is being challenged. I wrote about this very early on. I mean, when Mr. Trump challenges judges and refers to them as so-called judges, it's legislators who should be worried, because if he can talk like that about judges, then obviously the next step will be to talk that way about legislators. So I think, you know, Mr. McConnell is right to have that reaction. I think they should probably be much more concerned than they are. One scenario that I worry about a bit is that, or rather more than a bit, is that Republicans, although they're aware of some of Mr. Trump's flaws, stay with him as long as they think they need to get their own legislative priorities passed.
Or to survive.
Right. But by the time any of that happens, the system itself will already have been changed to a point where they're no longer going to be playing the same game that they were before. It's clear that what they're doing right now is they're normalizing more than they should because they have certain legislative priorities. My own personal view is that, like, I think tax cuts for the rich are a dumb idea. I think taking health insurance away from people is highly immoral. But I'm willing to accept that other people, you know, I understand people have other views on these things. My own personal view, though, about this is that whatever your policy preferences are, the question of whether the American system is being changed and the related question of whether a foreign power colluded with Mr. Trump and his associates in getting Mr. Trump elected, that those things are more important, or they take priority. So let's figure those things out first, and then we can go back to our legislative priorities.
Okay. So what I'm about to say is going to be flattering, and I don't want you to reject it out of hand. But you are one of the most important historians in the United States of America. Everybody knows it. Your reputation is extraordinary. You come out with this book, and a lot of people nod their heads, as I did the first time I saw any reference to it at all, and say, this guy has some real courage, because this is a person who doesn't like enemies, doesn't like people who call him. You ever worry in the middle of the night?
No. Look, I mean, I believe the things I say in the book, and I believe that we're in an exceptional moment. What I'm afraid, if you're asking me about fear,
fear.
Give me a break, right? I'll tell you what I'm afraid of. I'm afraid of a country where my children and grandchildren don't know what it means to be free. That keeps me up at night. I mean, me, myself, whatever, I'm one person, you know, that's not important. What's important is that there are millions of American children who are going to grow up in this. And I want them to grow up and have a free country, which means knowing what freedom is, which means not just getting through this little moment we're in now, but setting a good example in general, right? So, I mean, this is not about me or my emotions or whether I feel afraid or whatever, or whether you're flattering me. I mean, that's not important at all. That's the thing. The one thing that frightens me is the idea that 20, 30, 40 years down the line, there's going to be a country called the United States of America, and no one is going to know what being free means. That actually terrifies me.
On the way to that, secrecy is an interesting thing, because now we have all of these people getting up before the Congress of the United States and other places and say, sorry, can't answer that question. That's confidential information. The more confidential information, the less people know. Obviously, the further along we are to the very things that you're warning about in your book, which is authoritarianism taking over. What about this idea of how much is secret in the United States?
This is a whole great subject on which I have, you know, limited expertise, but let me just make 2 points. The first is related to the ongoing Russia hearings, to which I think you're referring. It really doesn't make a lot of sense for public servants to be claiming secrecy when the question is whether they're revealing the secrets of the United States to another country, right? So for Michael Flynn to be pleading the Fifth about documents, when the question is, the actual question is, let's face it, how much did he, as national security advisor, continue to play the role that he played before he was national security advisor, namely cooperating with the Turkish and Russian governments? When that's the question, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense for him to be pleading secrecy. That's my minor remark. My major remark is, I'm not sure that secrecy is the issue so much as the larger problem of who knows what about whom. So there are plenty of things which shouldn't be secret but are. But there are probably more things, or also a lot of things, which ought to be secret and aren't. The email scandals in the last campaign really trouble me, but not for the reasons they trouble everyone else. I mean, there are a lot of weird things going on. Like, so Secretary Clinton is criticized for having a private email server, which it turns out is more secure than the government server because the Russians have penetrated the government once, right? We're in a very weird world here. But the overall thing, or the underlying thing which concerned me, is that we now think it's normal for someone, whether it's the Russian government or the American government or a private actor or any actor, it's normal for someone to get into other people's private lives and dump things, and then for us to react to that. That's what really troubles me. It's not so much the secrecy, it's the control of personal data by non-public figures. I mean, when Michael Flynn agrees to become national security advisor, at that moment, Michael Flynn has a whole hell of a lot less privacy than you or I do, because he is the most important figure at the top of a national security chain. He therefore is going to be subject to higher standards than you or I, and he shouldn't be pleading the Fifth. That's totally ridiculous. But for the rest of us, the question is how that national security apparatus and other national security apparatus are dealing with our personal lives. And part of what happened in 2016 is that too much of what should have been private ended up being in public. People were afraid because they didn't know what was going to come up. And that actually also pushes us in an authoritarian direction, because if people are afraid of what governments or others are going to do with their emails, it becomes much harder for them to communicate. And that's clearly already happening.
Well, I think I agree with that, except the premise of my earlier question is this. If somebody gets up there, the head of one of our major intelligence agencies, and says, you know, I can't tell you that, Congressman or Senator, I can't tell you that, how are we as citizens going to ever make up our minds about what's what if we don't know the information? You can't have democracy unless you have information, right?
No, I completely agree with that. And I'm generally on the side of government transparency.
Okay.
And the number, you know, the number of times when something is truly a pressing national security interest is relatively low. And the idea that it's of national security importance what private individuals on the Trump campaign did in 2016, you know, that's obviously totally ludicrous. They weren't even in the American state at the time. They were just people making their they were just people choosing to cooperate with Russia. And why they did it, under what motives and what they said, those are the kinds of things that we have to be able to find out.
I want to ask you about Saturday Night Live. When the history of all of this is written one way or another, there's SNL coming out and making fun of the president, and I mean in ways which we've never seen before, in my opinion. How important, in terms of a cultural phenomena, is the fact that the comedians are after the president, making points that you're making, but making them before millions of people?
So I'm going to be a historian now for just a minute. There is a predictable relationship between authoritarianism and comedy, which is that when authoritarianism starts, comedy gets a lot better. And this is clearly true in the United States, right? People are funnier now than they were a year ago. But there are lots of historical precedents. So I work in Eastern Europe. Poland in the 1930s was a lot funnier than Poland in the early 1920s. Poland in the 1970s was a lot funnier than Poland in the 1990s. If for comedy, you need just the right amount of threat. If there's not enough threat, then things aren't so funny. But if there's too much threat, then all the comedians are put in prison, and you know, then things aren't funny either. That's the larger point I would make. I mean, I think it's really important that comedians are doing what they're doing, not just Saturday Night Live, but a lot of the late night people. But you know, what it teaches us is that we are, like other societies, we react to threat by laughing. And sometimes the laughter is that emotional moment we need to actually realize the truth of what's happening around us. So comedy serves a very important political function at times like this. But the sobering thing is that we have to recognize, look, we're at a time like this. We're not special, wonderful, exceptional America where nothing bad can happen. The fact that things are so funny is a sign that bad things are happening. And then you have to use the truth that you get out of the comedy to, you know, not just to feel better, but to motivate yourself to do something the next morning.
Historians write about what happened. You're writing as you're going. Is that challenging?
I mean, it's a different vocation. So if you're, let's say you're a neurologist, but then somebody was hit by a car across the street. You still have an MD. You should probably run across the street and do something. I feel a little bit like that. What I'm doing now with this book or in talking to you is not the same thing as sitting in an archive, having unlimited time, trying to figure out some moment in 1938, which is my day job and what, and frankly, what I like to do and what I would like to be doing, what I prefer to be doing. This is a different vocation, and I accept it. I accept it as such. It has different rules. You operate in conditions of much less certainty. You're engaging with different kinds of people. That's fine. The reason I'm doing it is because I take this to be an exceptional moment, which demands that all of us take certain kinds of small risks that we wouldn't otherwise take. So yeah, it's a challenge. I mean, the key is that I understand that being a historian helps me, like just like being a doctor would help you if you ran across the street, being a historian helps me to see certain things that other people might not see. And what I'm trying to do is follow my own advice in the book, is like do the little thing that I'm competent to do in an exceptional way, because this is an exceptional time.
Did you think your book on tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century, would take off the way that it has? Did you have any premonition that this was going to be as incredibly important as it is?
No, not really. I mean, it was, as I was just saying, it was in the category of doing the thing that you think you can do. I mean, part of acting in civil society is taking that spot where you feel comfortable, where you are well-informed, where you can defend some little patch of territory, where you can reach out to other people who have the same interests. You know, acting in civil society is not about mastering the whole terrain. It's about doing one little thing, doing it well, doing it every day, doing it with other people, doing it in public. That's all I'm doing, right? I mean, history is something that I know. I've got certain intuitions about the present that come from the darker history that I write about, but also come from my friendships with people who have lived through or are living through right now authoritarian regimes. This is my little bit of turf. This is where I can make some kind of little stand. And that's what I'm doing, consistent with my own advice. That it's helpful to other people is really wonderful. In part, I think, because it shows that the premise of the book was right, that a lot of Americans were going to be surprised and shocked by what happened, but that many of us would not be certain what to do. And the book is just that. It's a modest attempt to get people going.
Well, let me ask you one last fun question, and then we'll let you go. You've been wonderful in giving us all this time. And that is, when you look at the kinds of things that you're worried about, which president in history do you think had the best understanding of the message you're giving out here?
Well, I'm an American and I'm a historian, but I'm not an American historian. So I hadn't thought about it in those terms. I mean, I'm not going to dodge, but what I'm going to say is that the premise of the book is you don't count on the presidents. I think in my own amateur understanding of U.S. history, I think we've been lucky. I think we got lucky with Washington. I think we got lucky with Lincoln. And I think we got lucky with Roosevelt. And I think right now we're just not lucky. That's one of the things that's happened. We have a bad leader at an important time. And it's the first time we've had a truly bad leader at a truly important time. And so now it's not down to the president. It's down to us. In terms of, you know, I'm going to say something. I'm going to answer it from a slightly different angle. And I'm going to say Lincoln, because the basic message of the book, or one of the basic messages, is there's important stuff happening. You individually can make a difference, but you can't let yourself get overwhelmed, right? So I've been thinking about Abraham Lincoln a lot lately, because Mr. Trump said, you know, he's complaining, or he's a whiner, basically. I mean, he complains that he's a subject of the worst witch hunt in history, et cetera, et cetera. And I think of Lincoln, who was subject to so much abuse. And not only was he subject to so much abuse, he was facing a real challenge, the greatest challenge in the history of the Republic, namely that if there was a civil war, the Republic could be taken apart. There was a high moral issue, the issue of slavery. And at the end of it, he was killed for his trouble. I've been thinking of Lincoln a lot, because one thing Lincoln understood was that in all of this whirl, in all this overwhelming pressure of the everyday, you have to stay close to the things that you think are right. Right. So I'm going to answer Lincoln for that reason.
And I know we're out of time, but I just wanted to say in response, how about habeas corpus? So we've been talking to Yale professor Timothy Snyder about his latest book on tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. I'm Alan Chartok. Professor Tim Snyder, thanks so much for joining us today. It has been a great honor and privilege to be able to talk to you.
Pleasure was mine, Alan. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.